It's Let's Talk here on a Tuesday. Jeff and Scott with you. We'll have some open phone time coming up in the final segment of this morning's show.
Come on, folks. You love to talk politics, so yes, you do. Now, this is not a political issue we're going to talk about here, but in a sense it is. All right, when we talk about the economy, record highs, everything is great. Is it? Maybe? Sorta? Not? Okay. I mean, we're surrounded by conflicting information. And the idea is, okay, what's legit here? What's accurate? Maybe what's exaggerated? You know, that sort of stuff. So we want to thank our friends, as always, from Juniata College in Huntingdon, who referred us to our guest, Dr. Brad Andrew. First off, Dr. Andrew, good morning, and thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on. I very much appreciate it.
Now, I'm just curious. Well, this got nothing to do with our topic. You're in Huntingdon. What's the weather like down there?
We only got about a couple inches of wet snow, so it's sticking to the trees, which is pretty, but it's falling right off, and it wasn't as big as predicted, you know, no 5 to 8 inches here.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
So in other words, school, the college I'm talking about, school is not disrupted today?
Oh, no, not at all, and even if it were, I mean, Zoom has been just really helpful, so I can do virtual classes if there is a big storm. And in fact, I did that earlier this academic year. So,
all right. Well, first off, let's get some background on you, because we're going to talk about the economy. We have lots of questions. Tell us something about yourself. What is your background? Maybe like what do you teach at Juniata College and so on. Go ahead.
I have been at Juniata for almost 23 years. I grew up in a suburb of Boston, and in fact went to the local state college, Framingham State, and to get my bachelor's degree. Then I got my master's and my PhD in economics, and my focus is economic history. Although in recent years I've become the faculty overseer for the Eagle Fund, which is our student managed investment fund. So I've been more interested and focused on investing over the last decade or so.
Okay, I'm just curious. Record highs on Wall Street. Yay, wonderful. How's your fund doing? Doing great?
Yeah, no, it's doing very well, in fact, the last few years we've beat our benchmark on risk-adjusted returns, so we're doing well, and more importantly, the students are learning about proper investment strategy and how best to invest for the long term.
So, in other words, now, the kids, the students make these decisions, or, I mean, how does that work exactly?
Yeah, they make the decisions. They decide which securities we would like to sell, which securities we'd like to buy. They decide how large a position we can take. They also, more importantly, decide on the investment policy statement, which delineates their responsibilities and also their limits. There are certain things they can't do. No crypto, no taking complex positions in options or anything like that. Otherwise they have a free hand unless they want to do something crazy like that, and then I stop them.
No crypto, huh? Okay. I mean, do the students, I mean, this is a fund. Do they make money? Like, put in their pocket money from this?
Yes. No, this was money was donated approximately 21, 22 years ago by the late Claire Sunderland. The value of the money here is in the sense that it makes the students think more carefully about what they're doing. And I've had email exchanges with alumni who are members of the fund who were portfolio managers, and they note that the class would often meet at 8 a.m. in the morning, and later, that while there, they came to their sessions very sure about themselves. However, in discussions with their fellow portfolio managers, they became unsure. And that sense of gravity that comes from the fact that you're managing actual money really does add a dimension of reality. And now other schools have this. I'm sure Smeal has such an account, but you know, we have about 1,250 students, and there are very few small colleges that have a fund like this.
Yeah, so, that's very cool.
So you're playing with real money. It changes. Yes. It changes the perspective a little bit.
It does. It does. If it were play money, one wouldn't take it seriously. But our students do take it seriously, and it helps them later because it gives them exposure to thinking about real issues that affect the bottom line, and the fact that this is really not their money. They are fiduciaries. They have to think about the best interests of the Eagle Fund and also the people who will have the same responsibility 2 years, 5 years, 10 years later.
All right, let me kind of start with this question, which might seem like an odd question, I guess. And the question is, okay, there are economic issues and there are consumer issues. Are they necessarily the same? All right. This is Scott. When I see economic issues, I think Wall Street, you know, the top, you know, Jamie Dimon, you know, JP Morgan and so on. When I think consumer issues, it's me going to the grocery store and buying stuff. Are those two, economic and consumer issues, are they actually connected, or seemingly are they just really separate when it comes to the economy? What do you think about that?
I say for the most part, they are separate because Wall Street banks like, you know, JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs used to be far more integrated into the real economy. In a sense, by that I mean they would provide services for initial public offerings for companies to go public. They would provide services for mergers and acquisitions. However, in recent decades, they've been far more focused on other areas that are less to do with kind of the real economy. In essence, for example, private wealth management, which just means managing the money of very rich people. That's one thing they do. Proprietary trading. In essence, they're trading with their own money in order to earn profits. And they have less to do with the real economy than they once did.
So was there a point at the past where somebody made a decision or there was a period of time where that started to change and that separation began? Or has this just been some kind of very slow, gradual process over, I don't know, decades, I guess?
It's been a gradual process, I would say, and it is in essence sort of going where the highest profits are. Thing is that if you're engaging in private wealth management, I mean, one of the great virtues of the American economy is it has created a lot of wealthy people, and managing their money is more profitable in many cases and more steady. That's probably a better way of saying it. A steady source of profits because the money is always there and you take a cut of it as a bank every year. And so it's a much steadier and increasingly larger share of profits. And so that's where one would channel more of their efforts.
Talk a little bit about the because I think inflation, while there's a general understanding, I'm not sure folks really have a deep appreciation for the impact that it can have on the overall economy. Can you talk about just kind of where we're at and maybe relate it to some of the historical economic situations when it comes to inflation and where we're currently at in this country?
We had a situation during COVID when the government and the Federal Reserve did what they really should have done, at least in terms of directionally, stimulated the economy by cutting taxes, increasing spending for the government, and cutting interest rates and making lending available for the Federal Reserve, our central bank. They did what they should, but they did too much of it, and it overstimulated the economy. Now, part of that was the supply chains that caused prices to go up, but I would argue that more of it was both the federal government and our central bank overstimulating the economy, and now they're trying to take a step back very quickly, and the Federal Reserve has done that by raising interest rates from, in essence, like 0% to over 5% in a year, which historically, I can't recall that ever happening since the Fed was founded in 1914, 110 years ago. So, inflation itself is something that we actually need a little bit of. The economy functions better if we have low, stable of inflation of about 2 to 3% a year. And the Fed has chosen 2% as their target. They could choose 2.5 or 3 as long as they maintain that and it's stable. People can plan, and that's an important part. If inflation gets too high, it hinders the functioning of the economy. But we don't want deflation. That is even worse. I should say even worse. It's bad. It can be bad too, in the sense that with deflation, what we often see are declining revenues with companies, and as a result, layoffs. Meanwhile, deflation can cause your mortgage to get bigger over time in terms of the real value of the money. You know, you borrowed money that was worth a given amount, and now that money is worth more, and now you have to pay back more, and deflation hinders the functioning of the economy. So what you in essence want is sort of like a Goldilocks level of inflation around 2%, 2.5%.
All right, we got about 2 minutes where we have to take a break. Doctor, let's get some quick definitions here. Deflation, stagflation. Every now and then I see those two terms. What do they mean exactly?
Deflation means that prices fall. Stagflation is an economy that's both stagnant with high unemployment, but also has high inflation. Stagflation occurs when we have some type of very strong, what we call supply shock. Like in the 1970s, suddenly oil prices like quadrupled. All right, everything became more expensive, so people had less money to spend. So that caused high inflation and a recession at the same time.
All right, now, your opinion, in the next year, 2 years, could either one of those maybe happen? Deflation, stagflation, going the wrong direction? Or is that just not possible? Is there any chance that any of those could happen?
Well, there's the chance, but I would describe it as very unlikely. Deflation is something that every Fed, every central bank in the world wants to avoid. And stagflation would occur if suddenly a crucial resource like all energy doubled or tripled or quadrupled in price very quickly. Those are the most likely. That would be the most likely cause, and that seems very unlikely.
Now, I related a story in the last hour. I was at a convenience store yesterday, and I picked up a little bag of chips You know, just one of those little bags of chips. And it was $2.49 for a bag of chips. And I put the bag back down. I'd like to see the price of the bag of chips go down. You're saying, Dr. Andrew, if that happened, that would actually be bad. I mean, that's a crazy example, but what do you think?
Yes. Okay, yeah, no, I do see your point. The thing is that we see the price of things go up, but we don't take into account the fact that the process that's causing those product prices to rise is also the process that's causing our wages to rise.
Well, yours maybe.
we'll see. No, actually, one of my we struggle to keep up with inflation too. But here at the college, but the point is, I'm talking the country as a whole, you know, and that's a little different. Certainly, there are some people that are not whose wages are not keeping up.
Let me jump in. We got to take a break. We'll have more on this coming right back.
Your home for the Goon and Ironhead, exclusively on Sports Radio 98.7.
The Fox Ironhead.
State wrestling program notched its 1,000th victory last night with a 35-3 win over Rutgers at the Bryce Jordan Center. The Nittany Lions won 9 of the 10 bouts. Levi Haynes and Aaron Brooks recorded falls. Terrell Barraclough and Lucas Cochran, who are both Utah natives, each moved up a weight class and knocked off a ranked opponent. Barraclough rode out Jackson Turley in the third period to earn a 4-3 win at 174, and Lucas Cochran went up to heavyweight and defeated 8th-ranked Yaris Slavikuski 8-3. The Nittany Lions will ride a 54-match win streak into Sunday's Big Ten dual season finale against Nebraska at Rec Hall. The Penn State women's golf team finished second in the 16-team field at the Columbia Classic. Junior Michelle Cox led the way, winning the individual title by 4 shots at 9-under.
Ironhead. We don't just talk sports.
The Fox.
We live it. Sports Radio 98.7.
The Fox. The Fox Sports Weekend.
For the past 65 years, there's only been one race where a legend can cement his legacy.
Jimmy Johnson's going to win the Daytona 500.
Or an underdog can experience a career-defining moment.
Finally, Michael Waltrip is going to win, winning the Daytona 500.
Who will experience that this year? The 66th running of the Daytona 500, February 18th.
Sports Radio 98.7.
The Fox.
Bear Belly's Beverage in downtown State College, located at 258 West Hamilton Avenue within the Hamilton Square Shopping Center. At Beer Belly's, they have over 500 beers, including domestics, imports, microbrews, seasonal selections, ciders, and more. Beer Belly's is open from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Saturday, noon to 5 p.m. on Sunday. Check out our website at beerbellysbeverage.com. Beer Belly's Beverage, 258 West Hamilton Avenue in State College. Beer better, Beer Belly's.
Talk about great prices. Center Hall Farm Store has fantastic deals to help you save money all winter long on heating wood pellets.
Come here, Bear. Come on. Come on.
Oh, yeah. And for your ferocious little pomapoo, shepherd, horses, and just about every other farm animal, even your birds. Center Hall Farm Store has created its own perfect, unique mixture of feed, along with commercial feed of your choice. Center Hall Farm Store, 110 West Allison Street, Center Hall. CenterHallFarmStore.com.
Hi, this is Corey Confer from Joel Confer Toyota in State College. Are you looking for a dealership to call home? Joel Confer Toyota is a locally owned family business that has been serving the community for over 45 years. Come see us and let us help you with your next vehicle experience. We're located at 120 East Clinton Avenue in State College, just behind the Waffle Shop on North Athens Street. Or visit us 24/7 at joelconfer.com. And remember, good things happen in your community when you buy local.
The title and tag service that is customer-friendly and locally owned is at Joel Confer Quality Pre-Owned in Pleasant Gap. And as part of the Joel Confer family of dealerships, Monica Prisk is experienced and has been serving customers for 13 years. Cameron Confer is on the title and tag team and is there to help you with all of your title and tag needs. Stop at Joel Confer Quality Pre-Owned at 475 East College Avenue in Pleasant Gap and have Monica or Cameron answer any of your title and tag questions. Remember, good things happen in your community when you buy local.
Happy Valley Weather. It is the K2 Roots Foxcast. In the wake of the gently falling silent shroud of snow last night, a snowball fight warning is in effect. If a snowball fight develops around you, take cover immediately or fight back.
Fox Forecast.
The accumulating snow is done. We'll have some leftover clouds today, the high 38 degrees. This is WeatherBell.com Chief Meteorologist Joe Bastardi.
Sports Radio 98.7. The Fox.
Let's talk here on a Tuesday. Jeff Byers, Scott Gazy. We'll have some open phone time coming up again in the final segment of this morning's program.
Again, we're talking about the economy, something that affects all of us. And daggone, I want that $2.49 bag of chips to go down, down. And less air in the bag of chips.
While you're at it.
Less price, more chips. Anyway, we're talking with Dr. Brad Andrew from Juniata College.
Bad for you.
Okay, yeah. All right. Now, here we are in 2024, election year. Claims are flying already in all directions and all that sort of stuff. People trying to make predictions. And if I'm correct, there are still some economists that still think somehow we're going to have a recession. I don't know when. So, Dr. Andrew, actually, let me lead with that. All right, there are still some people saying, oh, we're still going to have a recession. Now, maybe we need another definition here on what a recession is. So maybe start with that. And then what do you think about those claims that we still might have that later this year, next year, or sometime?
Well, the textbook definition of recession is two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth. Gross domestic product going down, which is a gross domestic product is a measure of national income. And so that's the textbook definition. However, officially, a recession isn't called a recession until the National Bureau of Economic Research reviews it and using many different data points and defines when it started and when it ended. So it's not as clear as it should be, but two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth is the standard definition. And to your second question, I would be really very surprised. I would be shocked if there was a recession in 2024. I mean, it would take some type of significant unexpected shock to do that. I would be very surprised. I'd be very, very surprised. And as to why people are still calling for a recession, well, you know, many people are they've been calling for a recession now for 2 years, and eventually they'll be right. but the thing is, it really is. I would argue is very unlikely to happen.
All right. Now, earlier you talked about interest rates, and the Fed famously wants to somehow get interest rates down to 2%, which before the craziness started a few years ago, it was kind of hovering around 2%. And at one point, it was 9%. That was really bad. Right now, it's down to somewhere around 3%. Doctor, I'm just wondering, is 2%, maybe things have just changed, is 2% now too low? In other words, it's just not sustainable. It's not realistic.
That's a good question. Right now their goal is to get inflation down to 2%, and it is hanging around 3% right now. And I think short term it probably is unrealistic, and the reason is that we really do have some changes in the real economy that are going to cause prices to rise. For example, many companies are growing weary of being so dependent upon China, given their government's haphazard and just sort of arbitrary actions. And also just in terms of providing a backup to China as a producer, they want to make their supply chain more robust. And so what that means is they're going to be relocating, many of their, production facilities to Mexico, to the United States, and to Canada, which are closer and, more secure. So, and that's going to be, that's going to involve some cost. So I tend to think that, getting down to 2% short term would be difficult. If one is talking about getting down to 2%, say over the next 2 to 3 years, that I think can be done without causing any kind of negative repercussions.
So why are these people, doctors, sticking to that number? Because I see more and more, talking heads and experts, they're all saying 2% just it's not legit anymore. Not going to happen. But yet the Fed, Jerome Powell and company, they want to stick to that number. Why? Is there a reason?
I would say credibility, in the sense that you've established a target, and moving away from that target would reduce the institution's credibility. Personally, I think if they said we plan to retarget to more 2.5 to 3%, and then stabilize at that level over the course of the next 2 to 3 years, and they said that, and then they did it, that would maintain the credibility that they have. And so I don't really necessarily think there's anything wrong with that. The potential advantage is that by having a slightly higher inflation rate, the economy runs a little bit hotter, and what you would probably see is slightly lower unemployment rates, and also people having a little bit more bargaining power with their employers. Not like it was in 2021 or 2022, but better than it was, say, in 2018.
Now, actually, you just mentioned something there. Unemployment rate. Now, the unemployment rate officially right now is, 3.5% or something. Doctor, I've always wondered about that, because I keep hearing about people that, for whatever reason, they've decided, I'm done. I'm not going to look for a job anymore. I'm done. I quit. I'm just going to go home and do stuff. I'm not going to get a job anymore. Is that, if we're talking about the actual total number of people not working, that 3.5% figure is not accurate, or am I wrong on that? Can you describe that?
No, you're right. You're right. What you're talking about, economists officially call discouraged workers. They've decided that they are just not. They can't get a job, or they can't get a job that they think is appropriate for their skill set, and so they just decide to leave the job market. Now, technically, if you leave the job market, if you're no longer looking for a job, you are no longer unemployed. You have to be seeking a job and be unable to find one in order to be counted as unemployed. But if you become a discouraged worker, then yeah, you're no longer part of the labor force, and so you're not counted. But you're right in the sense that there are a lot more people that are as a percentage of working age adults, there are more people not working than there are unemployed.
See, around here, the term discouraged workers just refers to radio employees. That's that's like an entirely different thing, I guess.
Roughly accurate, yeah.
we do see, Dr. Andrew, if you could talk just a little bit about the, is there a greater disparity? Is the disparity growing more between the haves and the have-nots, to oversimplify it, because while we hear that the economy is humming along and things are improving and there's a lot of economic factors that indicate that, we also, I mean, we've had several guests over the last 4 months or so here locally, but it is certainly representative of nationwide, but folks saying that they are seeing like widely increasing numbers of folks turning out to the food bank, widely increasing numbers of folks coming and saying, yeah, we need help with basic needs. We just went to an event on Saturday night, and we were talking with some folks with housing transitions and the number of people that are homeless or, you know, really struggling to be able to make their, you know, mortgage payments, the daily payments. Is there a gap widening, or what kind of explains the fact that we have, again, an economy that by most measures is doing very well, but seemingly a growing number of people that are in some pretty dire circumstances?
Well, that's an excellent question. The way I would address that is that even in a growing economy, there are going to be people who are struggling. And what I would say is that in 2020 and 2021, 2022, with all of the money spent by the federal government and all of the economic stimulation by the Federal Reserve, the economy was overheated for a while, and that what that did was that made things actually quite a bit better for people on the say the bottom 20% saw significant increases in wages and in job opportunities, and so things were very good historically, better than they had been since the late 90s. So we're talking about over 20 years. So it's not surprising that one would sort of see a decline. I don't want to sound like I don't want to sound cruel here. I very much feel for people who are struggling. It's just I think if you look at compares like over the last two or three years, absolutely things are up. I don't know if they're up if your comparison point is like 5 or 6 years ago. In terms of housing, a big problem of housing in State College, but also in many other major cities, is that there are restrictions on building the type of housing that would house a lot of people, multifamily housing. Many people want a single-family home, and local residents through the zoning boards have control over whether that happens. Now if there were pressure put on local zoning boards, I'm not just talking State College, but cities around the country, to build more multifamily housing units, even in sort of residential neighborhoods, then the same amount of property could hold more people, and what you'd see is fewer people homeless.
All right, now, Doctor, we only about 2 minutes left here. Obviously, presidential election, a lot of politicians already making claims of all kinds, Bidenomics and othernomics, and, you know, look at all the things we're doing and so on. Your opinion? Not the Fed. The Fed's a separate thing. Politicians, do they really have an effect on the economy? I've always believed it's us. We have the ultimate effect on the economy. If good or bad, you know, we pull back. I'm not buying that bag of chips, you know, la, la, la. How much do politicians actually have an effect on the economy? Yeah, or high or nothing?
I think that in terms of the Federal Reserve has a more consistent effect on the economy. The federal government can actually do You're right in the sense that it's the federal government's overrated, except if they decide to do something very different than they had done in the past, like during the year after COVID, when both the Trump administration and the Biden administration started sending out checks to everybody, or almost everybody. That had an effect on the economy, but unless something like that happens, you're right. The federal government has a very it has a limited effect on the economy unless they do something quite different, or unless they their effect is far more, I don't say subtle is the wrong word, but its impact is felt over a long period of time, and can be either negative or positive, but it's very hard to see unless it's something significant that happens during a short period of time, like, again, COVID.
Well, Dr. Andrew, we really appreciate your time this morning. We could go for another segment. I got plenty of other questions, but obviously, presidential campaign, we're going to be watching this, all the claims flying around.
I'm telling you, if somebody promises cheaper chips, they're going to get Geezy's vote.
Going to get my vote.
Dr. Andrew, we thank you very, very much for the time. We greatly appreciate it.
Hey, you're very welcome. It was a lot of fun to be on. I appreciate it.
All right, folks, let's talk as the program. We're not done yet. We'll come right back after this.